ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF Store and sponsored by Legg Mason. Legg Mason's sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. Legg Mason Investor Services LLC is not affiliated with the ETF Store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF Store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Legg Mason is a leading global investment company committed to helping clients reach their financial goals through long-term actively managed strategies. Legg Mason offers a broad range of equity, fixed income, alternative, and cash strategies worldwide. It is comprised of a diverse family of specialized investment managers, each with their own independent approach to research and analysis, and has over a century of experience in identifying opportunities and delivering astute investment solutions to clients. To learn more, please visit LeggMason.com.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate and Jason will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
Welcome to ETF Prime, Nate Geraci alongside Jason Lank. As always, thank you so much for joining us. I also want to thank the exclusive sponsor of ETF Prime, Legg Mason. We are going to jump right in here today. We have an absolutely packed show. So last week I was down in Hollywood, Florida, attending the world's largest ETF conference, Inside ETFs. It was an amazing trip. I was able to connect with all sorts of people from across the ETF universe. And on the last day I was there, we cut two great interviews that we're going to play for you today. The first is with ETF.com's Dave Nodig, who, of course, joins us most weeks on the show. Dave and I sat down over coffee. We were overlooking the Atlantic Ocean, and we just started recording our takeaways from the conference. This was a lot of fun. I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. And then after that, Dave and I were joined by Ambar Bajaj, Vice President, ETF Product Manager at Legg Mason. We got Ambar's key takeaways from the conference and some thoughts on Legg Mason's ETFs. So we're going to play both of those for you. And then later, we'll actually be joined by WisdomTree's Jeremy Schwartz. He's going to offer a few thoughts on the conference as well and spotlight a couple of WisdomTree ETFs. So let's start with Dave Nodig and I. Full disclosure, we were a bit slap happy here. We were tired. This was the last day of a very busy conference. But stick with us. Dave drops all sorts of wisdom on direct indexing, zero fee ETFs, Bitcoin and marijuana ETFs, and much, much more. Take a listen.
Dave, I've got to tell you, I'm tired. This has been a grind. It's been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed it. I'm tired. I'm ready to go home.
They pushed it to 4 days now. We started Sunday in the middle of the day with some great sessions, especially if you're an advisor or you're new to the space. They start with ETF 101, sort of a whole university day. Great content. And then two full days, you know, 8 o'clock, sometimes 7 o'clock in the morning with breakfast through the end of the night, 2 days. And then Wednesday, this half day that we're in right now, I feel like I've been through the trenches in World War I.
What does your schedule typically look like? I know I've been busy, but I feel like I've seen you everywhere, sometimes twice at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, over the years, it's changed. Obviously, you know, back in the day, ETF.com used to run this conference, and it split out. And so then it used to just be logistics, putting out fires, all that stuff. Now, you know, I did a couple of main stage sessions, and then everybody's shooting video here, including us. And I think that's become one of the major ways that people get the content out of this conference. Obviously, I have a team of writers and editors here writing content for ETF.com. So there's a process there, too. But I think we shot 20 videos over a two-day shooting window. And then just, you know, meeting people, right? This is the mecca of the ETF industry. So if you want to talk to, I don't know, a portfolio manager from PIMCO to find out what they're thinking about interest rates, this is the place to do it.
Well, let's talk about your main stage presentation that you did with Matt Hogan. This is something you guys do every year. You offer sort of a state of the ETF union. And there are some interesting stats. One was that since 2009, ETFs have taken in $2.3 trillion. Mutual funds have lost $92 billion. And so that sort of set the stage for your presentation, certainly talked about the growth of ETFs, but it was interesting. You pivoted sort of mainstream in that presentation and talked about what the future may look like.
Right.
And talked about how there's always been fund evolution. And the topic of direct indexing came up and how that could potentially pose a threat to ETFs and certainly mutual funds. First, high level, can you just explain what direct indexing is?
Oh, sure. So, and this is not a new concept. Institutions have been doing this forever. You know, if you want to own the S&P 500, but you're an Apple employee, you probably shouldn't have Apple be your largest position in your S&P 500 allocation. That's really tough to do. I mean, just that one thing, as you know, this is a financial advisor. You have clients who come in, they're heavily concentrated in their lives somewhere. You probably shouldn't double down. Really tough to do if you're that, you know, that Apple employee with that big Apple stock position sitting in options. You're probably legally not allowed to short out Apple from your SPY exposure. And certainly it would look bad when you talk to your boss about it. So how do you buy the 499 other stocks? So direct indexing is a way to solve that problem, to be able to say, I'm going to take the intellectual property of an index, but I'm going to tweak it because not every person is the same. And even the same exposure will have different impacts on different people based on what else they own, based on what their other exposures are.
Well, so, you call this the great unwrapping,
right?
Because it's not in a traditional 40 Act wrapper. How big of a threat do you really think this is longer term? Is this something that is an existential threat to the status quo of funds, or is this something that maybe might take a little bit of market share? How big of a threat is this?
So I think people misinterpreted, you know, Michael Lewis, who was also here, had a great quote that, you know, as an author, you write the book, and then as a reader, you read the book, and it's only occasionally that those things are connected, right? People read what they want to read. The point I was making, I actually, in our prediction for the ETF market, we're actually more bullish on the next 10 years for ETFs than we were 10 years ago. I actually pulled in my prediction of when I think ETF assets cross mutual funds by a year to 2024. So I actually think ETF growth is accelerating. What I'm talking about with the direct indexing models, or you know, however we want to call these, the unwrapped model, is not an existential threat that gets rid of mutual funds or ETFs. It's the next thing that starts attracting assets. So if you are a young advisor building a practice, you're 25 years old, you're going after that great $30 trillion millennial wealth transfer, you know, should you be focused on closed-end funds? Of course not. That wouldn't be where you would go. You'd focus probably on ETFs. The point we're making is the next thing coming down the line as an advisor is going to be the ability to really customize the portfolios for your customers, not at an asset allocation level, but back at that single security level. Now, nobody wants to do that. You don't want to go get 3,000 stocks for your clients. And so direct indexing is a way of solving that problem without all the complications of running a, you know, 1970s era 200 stock portfolio for every client.
Okay, so I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate. When you use the word customize, I think active management. And so if an investor has the ability or an advisor has the ability to start screening out things they don't want to own, let's say it's gun stocks or Apple stock, at some point you're introducing fairly significant active management into the process, potential tracking error. There are transaction costs involved with executing those trades. You may have somebody who maybe doesn't understand the tax implications of what they're doing. Obviously, tax loss harvesting can be beneficial at the individual security level, but you could have somebody sell out of a position because maybe they don't want to own, you know, some subset of stocks. Isn't it really active management in disguise? And not that that's necessarily bad, but that has certainly proven to trip up investors in the past.
Yeah, so I think you have to separate the sort of I have a gut feeling about Microsoft thing from the I'm tweaking my asset allocation for my circumstances. You do this right now. Wait, you have a client walk in the door. You have to make a choice about whether their large cap exposure is Russell 1000 or S&P 500 or MSCI 350, right? I mean, these are plain vanilla 10 basis point beta products that all say large cap U.S. equity on the cover, And they have different portfolios in them, right? And they're 150 stocks different between the MSCI 350 and the S&P 500, right? That's a huge, that's an active bet. You made an active bet on 150 stocks you don't or do want to own. And all we're doing here is saying, instead of just relying on the index provider to say, no, our sauce tastes better than the next person's sauce, how about have that sauce be relative to your client's actual needs, demands, wishes, and wants? Now, I'm not suggesting the whole market's going to flip this way next week. I think I'm probably going to retire in the ETF industry. I just think that this is where asset management and particularly the relationship between advisors and their clients is headed 10 years, right? That's where it's going to go. And the thing I think that people should be most worried about is when you think about investing this way, it's fundamentally a software problem, right? All the things you're talking about, like, you know, tax loss harvesting and, you know, introducing tracking error and how do I control for that? How do I manage that so that I don't end up with a portfolio that looks crazy, unlike what I wanted for basic exposure? All of those are software problems. And, you know, the industry, the ETF industry, isn't necessarily that great at software, right? They're great at packaging up products in wrappers. Who's great at software? Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Facebook, those big companies. They also all happen to have big brand, big distribution. That's where it could start being an existential threat, but not to advisors, not to investors, not to index providers, to issuers.
Okay, let's talk about another topic that I was a bit surprised at, I guess the way this was positioned, zero fee ETFs. And I thought there might be more discussion around that, but it actually feels like the industry is perhaps now drawing a line in the sand and they're pushing back a little bit.
I wonder why, Nate.
Well, so there was a great quote. State Street's Rory Tobin was asked the question, is the right price for simple beta zero? And his response was, the right price for anything you value would never be zero. And in just conversations that I had, it definitely feels like, look, somebody's going to come out with a zero fee ETF. I think we both can agree on that. But it does feel like the industry is saying, hey, look, we're down at a few basis points. A basis point here or there doesn't matter. Do you think we have reached a bottom on fees? Again, notwithstanding somebody will launch a zero fee ETF at some point, but in general, do you think we've reached kind of that floor on fees?
I don't think anybody cares too much about the difference between 8 and 7 basis points. I think they care about the difference between 80 basis points and 7 basis points. And those fee battles still have to be fought, right? There are still corners of this market that I think are very expensive. Look, I put up on stage during our best new ETF smackdown a series of products from Innovator. We've talked about them several times on the show, the defined outcome products. They're legitimately expensive. They're like 79 basis points. Now, it's a tough strategy to manage. It requires a lot of thought. It's got trading that needs to happen. So it's not necessarily the wrong price, but could it be half of that? And would that be better for investors? Of course. So I think what you're going to see is, you know, sort of like with audio, you compress things down, but the sound never goes away. I think we're going to see that compression continue to happen, but the center of the compression isn't going to be zero. It's going to be 10 basis points or something like that. So we'll see people arguing for the value of their products, to Rory's point, arguing for the value of their products over beta based on the exposures, based on the expected performance, based on their risk management. So I don't think we're going to see zero as much more than a gimmick, really, in my lifetime.
You mentioned the Innovator ETF. So every year, there's something called the Battle of the Pundits. And there's a fantastic group of ETF gurus who basically get up on the main stage and make a presentation for the best new ETF of the past year, so best new ETF of 2018. So Eric Balchunas, Matt Hogan, Ben Johnson from Morningstar, Elizabeth Kashner from FactSet, Tom Lyon at ETF Trends, yourself, and of course, Todd Rosenbluth over at CFRA. Some great tickers were out there. So Eric had the Perth Gold ETF, physical gold ETF, which I think you had the rebuttal to, if I remember correctly. Matt Hogan had the eSports ETF.
And one.
And one from VanEck. Ben Johnson had a Vanguard multi-factor. Elizabeth had one of the J.P. Morgan, I think the
Japan beta builder.
Beta builders. Tom had XLC, right? Communications. And then Todd had Deutsche, the X-Trackers.
Right, the
QARP,
quality at a reasonable price.
So right. I would love your take. You have the first opportunity to tell us who you think should have won, assuming not yourself.
Right.
I'll tell you who I think should have won. What was your take on how this all went down? So you already mentioned Matt Hogan won with eSports.
Right. Well, we should point out to listeners who are not in the audience and are reading this coverage, and look, we take the winner of this, and they show up at the ETF.com awards in March. So it looks,
I didn't know that,
it looks quite serious on paper, but I think it's worth saying that the genesis of this was this is a window in the conference that over 10 years is very difficult to get people in the room. It's the second to last session of the day. The last session of the day, you always put, like this year, Joe Montana or something like that. You do some big thing to get people back in the room, to send people off happy to cocktail hour. But the presentation right before that is always impossible because everybody's like, it's Florida, it's 4 o'clock, we could have beer, if nobody would mind. And so because of that, they don't want to put something super important there that may not have a brand name.
That makes sense, and it was a packed session, we should say.
It was this time. The first year we did this, we had 100 people in the room at a 2,000-person conference.
And we should also mention John Swolf, CEO of Inside ETFs, actually wears a referee uniform and has a whistle up there on stage because the presentations are timed. Nevertheless, who should have won?
We're all very tired. We're having a lot of fun. We're all taking the you-know-what out of each other. That's the point of it. But we do take the process pretty seriously. So who should have won on merits? Of course, me. But who should have won other than me? I actually thought Todd Rosenblum.
I agree. That would have been my.
First of all, it's a great product, like the quality to reasonable price product. I know some people think quality is like the new smart beta. There's so many new quality products. But QARP, aside from being called CARP, which is hilarious, it's a really solid product launch from Deutsche that people really are. Sorry, DWS now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That people really should look at. And Todd not only presented it very well from an intellectual standpoint, he did it as a rap, as a man who should never rap in his lifetime. So he was both entertaining, but also had, I think, a very solid case for why it was a great product. One thing people don't realize about that, when they see the eight of us up on stage, we do like an NFL-style draft for who gets to go first and pick which one. So I got to go first, so I got to pick the innovator funds. Todd was second to last. Nobody else picked QARP before him, which is shocking. And it explains a little bit why Eric Balchunas in last place picked the Perth Mint.
Yeah, that's
gold
a tough
fund.
One. Trying to sell the physical gold is something exciting.
Very
that's a tough.
But you know, you have to realize that Eric picked last, so the best seven ideas were already gone.
Okay, a couple other topics I want to ask you about that I observed at the conference. And I'm sorry, I have to ask you about Bitcoin.
Okay.
In the same breath, we can talk about cannabis and marijuana. So, when I was here last year, Bitcoin and marijuana, I would say more than anything else, those were the two hottest topics of discussion. This year, I think there was one session on cryptos and there's one session on cannabis, but overall, not nearly the buzz.
Right.
Is that a sign of kind of where we're at with both of those? You know, my take is, just in having conversations, it certainly doesn't seem like a crypto or Bitcoin ETF launch is imminent anytime soon. I think that process is still working its way through the SEC. It does seem like we will probably have some additional marijuana ETF launches, was just my read in talking to people. What was your take just kind of on how both of those subjects were presented this year and just kind of the overall feel around both
of those? So, I mean, I think last year these were very new ideas. And now this year we're sort of in this, you know, I don't know if there's a smile, we're at the bottom of it, right? Where the initial products are filed. In the case of MJ, the initial product is out and traded and has been reasonably successful, at least in gathering assets. Now we're in this sort of regulatory lull. And, you know, if you were putting this conference together as an organizer and you're looking back, I don't know, October or something like that, and you're looking at the SEC agenda, it was pretty clear that nothing was going to be magically approved on December 31st to go into the new year. So we're in this regulatory lull where there's not a lot to talk about in terms of new product for an ETF.
So you think it's
investor.
More regulatory driven just in terms of the lack of buzz right now?
Well, also, you can't It's inarguable that marijuana stocks have taken it on the chin lately. And look at Bitcoin is like one of the greatest bear market stories in history over the last 18 months, right? So I know that you and Connor talk often about Bitcoin in different contexts. It's super interesting. Obviously, I'm really interested in it too. But I think we're also pretty clear-eyed about what it is and what it isn't. Nobody's talking about making 40% allocations to Bitcoin, at least not coming back on this show. So, you know, I think we have to recognize, look, this is a really interesting part of the market, but right now it's not the most relevant topic for an actual investor putting money to work.
Okay, what about ESG? So this was another topic last year that I think had a fair amount of buzz. This year, that trend continued. There was an excellent presentation by Paul Tudor Jones on the Just ETF.
Just Capital, right, and which is the index behind Goldman Sachs. JUST ETF, right.
And he was a fantastic messenger.
Well, he's a great speaker, obviously, and incredible resume.
I said I'm surprised he hasn't run for office, I mean, with as well as he presented. But what are your thoughts on ESG? I know we've talked a lot about it on past podcasts. Continues to be just a tremendous amount of attention on it. Asset flows are still light. Where are we with ESG?
Yeah, so I was actually surprised, too, how positive the reaction to ESG topics here was. There were a couple. So obviously there was the Paul Tudor Jones presentation. There was a great panel with a handful of folks, including the woman from ESGI, Ms. Lee, who's phenomenal. I think that there is a growing realization that ESG is not just I'm a tree hugger, I want to go do a thing. It's actually kind of a core part of the investment process. And you can ignore it, right? Like just like you can ignore worrying about duration in your bond exposure and just buy the ag. So you can ignore it, but there's value to be had in thinking about it. And whether that's risk reduction, whether that's sort of outperformance, whether that's trying to actually have impact through your investments, there are a lot of facets to it. I think part of the reason it's getting a little more play than I expected is some of the focus on corporate governance. And that some of that comes to do with what happened in the midterms and a little bit of shift in investor thinking about the role of corporations in the economy. There's been a lot of press just in the last few weeks on buybacks. And it's been very polar. It's been somewhat vitriolic. I mean, I've read a few op-eds about how, you know, buybacks are immoral or, you know, we're using tax cuts to fund buybacks to, you know, juice the investor class, but we can't fund healthcare. So it's become like that is an ESG discussion.
Is that good or bad, though? Because I do think a lot of people tend to wrap sort of the political discussion into ESG, and sometimes it may be viewed through a political spectrum. Is that good or is that bad?
Well, whether it's good or bad, it's complicating, right? So from our perspective, it makes it interesting, so we can talk about it. I think it's good in the sense that it's the right conversation to have. I'm not going to sit here and be pedantic and say what the answer is, but I think the role of corporations and governance and how they treat employees and how we allocate capital as a society, the role of government in that, those are legitimate things that we as a country should discuss, and it's a legitimate thing for an investor to be worried about. Part of the reason I think the Just Capital thing resonated so well, aside from the fact that Paul Tudor Jones is a great speaker and has some great ideas, is that instead of saying this is what matters, he was saying, hey, you know what? You tell us what matters. And that's what's different about the Just approach, is that they actually survey the American people and say, what do you care about? And they come back and say things like, well, how companies treat their workers is really important. Okay, we're going to allocate more capital to companies that we believe are treating their workers well because that's what you told us. And that's a very different approach than saying, here's our portfolio that doesn't have gun stocks in it. Do you want to buy it? I still believe that ESG is a pretty personal thing, and this is part of my shtick on direct indexing. Much easier to implement this accurately for your client as an advisor if you can tweak those things, if those are just sliders on a scale. I think the problem with ESG in an ETF or a mutual fund format is it's going to be one size fits all no matter what.
Well, and that's why I thought Paul Tudor Jones was such a good messenger, because he was able to distill the message down to something that I think was more compelling and understandable. All right, last question. Obviously, inside ETFs, a big focus is ETF education. There are a lot of financial advisors here. But I had a really interesting conversation with someone named Sarah Newton. So She's out on social media, has a really large social media following, interesting, delusional trader, I think is a handle she has, but she kind of trades on her own. But in talking to her, she was like, hey, you know, the conference is really good. I've learned a lot, but there's not a whole lot of individual investors around here. And I don't know that that was her expectation. I think she knew it was more of an industry-focused conference. But what she said was, you know, she wondered how much the ETF message is actually making its way out to individual investors. And that almost there's a bit of an echo chamber within the ETF industry where advisors understand what's going on. They understand, you know, all the things that we're talking about here. But that the end investor is still maybe not understanding some of the potential benefits of ETFs and some of the different strategies that they can capture in an ETF wrapper. I'm just curious, do you have any thoughts on that? Do you feel like it is a bit of an echo chamber? You know, we're obviously focused on ETF education, ETF.com, ETF education. Is it a problem? And if it is, how do we get the message out to individuals?
Well, I think it's inarguable that it's an echo chamber because that's the nature of these types of businesses, right? I mean, you go to the, I don't know, the NAB show where they do audio, you know, the big audio show every year, and that's an echo chamber too. Everybody says, oh, this is the latest whiz-bang thing, and everybody gets saying the same thing, and, you know, the musician on stage may never care, right? And so the question is, how do those things sync up for the benefit of the end user, in this case, the investor? So look, the ETF education game is never over, right? I think people are always surprised how many people show up, say, at the ETF 101 here every year, right? It packs a 600-person room every year, year after year. And you'd be like, haven't the advisors gotten it yet? No, because there's another 600 advisors that haven't heard it. The challenge is to reach a mass market, to reach the millions of investors that are trying to save for retirement or trying to save to put their kids through college, you need a big megaphone, right? And this is a small place, right? I mean, yeah, it's a huge conference for ETFs. It's 2,500 people. I had a great experience in the elevator coming here. You know, a conference was leaving as this conference was setting up, and this woman was here for, I don't know, a lawyer's conference or something, and she's like, oh, what's coming in? And I told her, you know, inside ETFs. She's like, oh, that's interesting. You know, I'm an investor. Well, how many people will be here? And I said, 2,500. She says, there are 2,500 people who care about ETFs, right? And I thought that was very telling, like that this was an individual investor who knew about ETFs, who was shocked that there was this big industry. So where does that megaphone come from? It's going to come from the traditional places that spend the money to reach those audiences. You know, Fidelity, you know, Janus. Like, these are names that individual investors tend to know because they've had decades of marketing messaging to those individual investors. And a lot of those players are still actually quite new in the ETF space. So, you know, it falls a bit to, you know, the SPDR brand, the iShares brand, to the Invesco brand, right? Those are the folks that can afford to have a big megaphone to reach those individuals. Now, obviously, there's problems with that because they're going to talk their own book, sure, as they should. That's marketing spending. They should do that. But putting it in context for that individual investor, I think, is a real challenge. Even something like CNBC, which, you know, so a lot of individual investors flip that on during the day. You know, they're going to look at their portfolio twice a day or something like that. Even there, 25 years into the ETF revolution, the ETF coverage is still pretty skimpy. I mean, Bob Pisani launched a new show a couple weeks ago on Mondays called ETF Edge, and that's the first time they've had dedicated ETF content on CNBC.
Good example. Well, you know, if it's a challenge, that also means there's tremendous opportunity.
Sure.
And I think the presentation that you and Matt gave, where you talked about the growth of ETFs moving forward, potentially surpassing mutual funds, if we can continue to raise the bar on ETF education as an industry, everybody will benefit and we'll continue to see that growth. Dave, really enjoyed it. Conference has been a blast. Thank you.
Thanks for having coffee with me. This is great.
All right, so that was ETF.com's Dave Nottig. I really enjoyed that conversation, and I do think we hit on just about all of the key takeaways from the conference. That was actually a pretty good recap. All right, next I want to play our chat with Legg Mason's Ambar Bajaj. He's Vice President ETF Product Manager there. Legg Mason currently offers 10 ETFs with over $800 million in assets. They manage over $725 billion in assets as a firm overall. But you could really feel Legg Mason's presence at Inside ETFs. It seemed clear to me they're getting pretty serious about ETFs. So Dave and I got Ambar's take on the conference itself, and then we talked about the future of ETFs for LEG and the industry overall. Take a listen to this.
Ambar, a pleasure having you here.
Thanks. Great to be here, Nate.
So we are sitting here in Hollywood, Florida on the last day of Inside ETFs. You've been here the entire time. Dave, you've been here the entire time. Ambar, what's been your take on the conference?
Very exciting and also very exhausting, I would say. I mean,
I will
there
concur
is,
with that.
There is coffee on the table. Yeah. We should confirm that. Yeah.
Exactly. No, it's been great to reconnect with colleagues all around the ETF industry and also learn, there's been a flood of new managers, a flood of new issuances, and it's just been great to kind of stay on top of all that.
So there have been a ton of different topics covered. I think every topic that we cover here on ETF Prime, certainly, Dave, you cover at ETF.com. What stood out to you? Is there anything that in particular has resonated that you've noticed has been more front and center?
Yeah, definitely. I think I would say the first and foremost is active management, by and large, both in terms of the sponsors, new active sponsors coming to market with ETFs and active ETFs, as well as the advisor's reception to active strategies in an ETF, which I think we've all been kind of wondering in the ETF industry is that when is it going to really catch on? And I think, we're at that moment where we could really start to see more significant inflows there.
You know, something that I've noticed, and I've been pretty vocal about this in the past, is I've noticed active managers who have a really deep tradition in active management, maybe the old guard active managers, have been somewhat hesitant to launch their flagship equity strategies in an ETF wrapper. And I know one of the concerns there is the transparency of the ETF wrapper, where active managers perhaps don't want to give away their secret sauce, right? They don't want to have trades front run. Do you view that as a legitimate concern? Do you think that has been one of the barriers to having these flagship equity strategies offered in an ETF wrapper?
I mean, I think there's been a few different barriers that I would say traditional active managers, as you say, have faced over the years. I think what they're realizing is that investors and sponsors alike are growing increasingly aware of the strengths of the ETF vehicle, right? I mean that's why we're all here at ETF.com, right? And namely the tax efficiency, the lower cost, the liquidity, the tax fairness, and that's where flows have been going. So I think a big part of it is, I think there's two big reasons. So first off, of the $17 trillion or so left in mutual funds, and 14 of that in active, how much are you going to get to keep, right? If you don't evolve to the newer structure, and I think the second point on that, which is very important to LEG, is offering a diversity of choice to your clients and being able to offer them what they need in the structure and in the vehicle they want. And I think more and more sponsors are growing accustomed to this. And to your earlier point about whether, are you giving up the secret sauce of active managers? I mean, Western is a great example of that. In the active bond space, with the two ETFs that we have there, we're making holdings available every day, daily disclosure. In fact, every single one of our active ETFs is disclosing holdings daily. So I think they've gotten over that. And, if you think about what spaces it really matters into, and most of the publicly listed equities in markets, there's not really that much of a concern of front running. You're not really going to front run the S&P 500, right, or the 500 stocks or so that are in there, right?
And LEG's in an interesting position there because you sort of have a lot of options on that. Not only do you have a lot of different strategies to choose from, and if there is a micro cap growth strategy sitting in a corner somewhere that manager might not be comfortable disclosing, you guys have made investments in folks like Precidian, who are working on the non-transparent active side of things. But at the same time, you are bringing traditional active, very high active share products that have, just a few dozen holdings, which I think addresses the other concern I think some folks have had around asset management is, isn't it all just benchmark hugging? Most of your strategies don't look anything like that. They're very high conviction strategies.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and to that point as well, you very well mentioned our breadth of affiliates and our continuing mission to offer a variety of choice to our clients. So yeah, that fits right in there.
Can you talk a little bit more about that affiliate structure for people who maybe aren't familiar with Legg Mason? Explain how you're leveraging these independent investment managers?
Absolutely, yeah. So Legg Mason is comprised of 9 different affiliate companies that are each their own independent asset managers with their own unique specialties, and some with decades of live track records. So Western Asset, you know, a prominent bond fund manager, ClearBridge Investments, an exceptional equity manager, Royce, right, specializing in small cap for over 4 decades, very high active share, as you mentioned earlier. So Brandywine Global and Clarion and Trust, Martin Currie, Curest, to name a few others. So, yeah, there's been, we're very fortunate to be able to bring a variety of asset managers to our advisors and to our clients.
Well, you know, I agree with you in terms of active management being prominent here at Inside ETFs. And, you know, I think a lot of that is all of the plain vanilla beta exposure that's been spoken for.
That's right.
I think in many ways, the smart beta or strategic beta, whatever you want to call that space, a lot of product offering has been taken care of there. So I do think there's tremendous opportunity in active ETFs. I know we've talked about that. So I'm really interested just to see how that space evolves moving forward here.
Yeah, and you guys are playing in another one of the trends that I would highlight from here, which I was a little surprised at, which is the amount of talk about ESG. Right? I mean, a couple years ago, we had some panels on this, and people were like, nobody's ever going to pay attention to it. It was top of mind. There are a lot of folks with a lot of interesting products, and you guys have some launches in this space too.
Absolutely. And again, that was going to be another trend that I was mentioning. And I've attended a few panels on ESG, very, very innovative stuff, just from where we were a year ago to where we were 3 years ago. You know, when we talk, to other folks in the industry, we say, you know, ESG gains a lot of press, but maybe not as many assets that it really deserves. But if you look at some of our affiliates, ClearBridge, for example, is exceptional ESG manager. We have multiple ETFs with them, 3 at least that are that have ESG kind of built into it. And I would say that ClearBridge's whole vision and their brand really embodies the ESG culture in and of itself, without having to specifically list it even on each one of their strategies.
What do you think needs to happen? What sort of catalyst to really start driving investor interest in ESG? You made the comment there seems to be a lot of attention, media attention on ESG, right? Assets have been a bit slower to follow. What needs to happen there?
I think the same thing that, we've all been in the ETF industry long enough. The same thing that happened there needs to happen to ESG, whether it's in ETFs or mutual funds or what other structures, is that continuing investor education, right? Mm-hmm. So is ESG just a nice notion of doing good and limiting harmful companies? Or are there actually positive return factors associated with several of the ESG principles, which I know, several companies and index providers are doing a great job of highlighting those and creating new and innovative scoring metrics to let investors know how they can accurately assess ESG opportunities. So,
And if you look at the performance for your funds and for a lot of funds in the ESG space, sure, during the sort of peak of the sort of endless bull market we had a little while back, it was really tough for any active strategy, much less an ESG selection model, to beat the broad market, which was just momentum, momentum, momentum. You look at the performance in the third quarter and starting in the beginning of this year, a lot of ESG funds are actually outperforming, not because they're picking up a growth stock everybody else missed. They're missing some of the bums, right? And that's part of what you want out of an ESG strategy, is that risk management component.
That's right. And if you think about like idiosyncratic risks that you may not always be able to pick up through some smart beta or factor-based analysis, if you have somebody manning the helm, so to say, and looking at corporate governance at a closer level, looking at the executives, what they're getting into, you can really spot stuff there that can get you ahead of some very major down movements in a lot of big names.
Okay, so moving forward, Ambar, 2 questions here. What does the future of ETFs look like for Legg Mason? And then I'd love to hear your thoughts on what you think the future of ETFs looks like overall.
Sure. With Legg Mason, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of that, the beta, the passive space has been spoken for several times over at this point, I think.
Unless you want to get cheaper.
Right.
Always,
exactly.
You always go lower.
Yeah. The big 3, the big 4, the big 5 at this point. I mean, they're...
You're not hankering to launch 2 basis point equity?
Yeah, exactly. I can't even comment on that. But I think, what Legg will continue to do is offer the best and brightest kind of through their affiliate structure. So, Western Asset Core Plus, you know, the bond fund, great strategy with decades of consistent stellar performance relative to the benchmark. And for us to be able to bring that out to the ETF community, you know, at 45 basis points, you know, in an ETF wrapper with some slight modifications, but, you know, with WBND, our total return ETF, you know, a great solution kind of for advisors, but, again, leveraging that strength of our affiliates. And same thing with ClearBridge and with Brandywine, you know, as talks develop. So that's what I think you can continue to see from us is variations of our most, you know, successful kind of strategies that we think are really either innovative or provide something out there that, you know, has shown consistent performance, leveraging those teams.
And what about the future of ETFs overall? We talked a little bit about the opportunities for active in particular. How do you see the industry evolving?
I think the thematic ETFs will always be there. You know, I loved the sessions yesterday on you know, when each of the experts were picking their favorite ETFs. And, you know, the video game one, you know, growing up in you know, the 80s and 90s, playing as many video games as I have, you know, that one definitely struck a chord at the heart. So, but, you know, even besides that, I mean, there's constant innovation going on. There's constant ways to bring liquidity to newer markets. So, you know, I think investors are going to continue to see that, and I agree. I think a lot of the, you know, so to say, old school asset managers will continue to bring some of their best strategies and leverage their distribution capabilities to you know, hopefully come to market and try to stay relevant, to be honest, over the next 20 years.
Well, Ambar, an absolute pleasure having you on ETF Prime. I hope you get some sleep.
Yeah.
I know I will after a very busy 3 days. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks, Nate. Thanks, Dave.
So that was Ambar Bajaj, Vice President, ETF Product Manager at Legg Mason. And look, Ambar is right. There's constant innovation occurring in ETFs, whether in the thematic ETF space, active ETFs. And I don't think there's any question we're going to continue seeing more of the old school asset managers like Legg getting involved here. Really enjoyed that discussion with Ambar. Now, we're a bit crunched for time, so we're going to move on here. We are now very pleased to be joined by Jeremy Schwartz, Global Head of Research at WisdomTree. WisdomTree currently offers 85 ETFs with nearly $40 billion in assets. And you talk about ETF innovation, WisdomTree has to be near the top of that list. And as it turns out, I actually had an opportunity to moderate a panel on alternative ETFs last week at Inside ETFs. Jeremy was one of the panelists. And we had a tremendous discussion on an area where there is no question a ton of innovation occurring right now in alternative ETFs. And WisdomTree has some really interesting products in this space. We'll discuss a few of those with Jeremy, who is now joining us via phone from New York. Jeremy, as always, great having you on the program.
Nate, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, I first want to say it was nice to finally meet in person last week. I know we've talked several times in the past, but we never met in person. Glad we were able to do that. First, any takeaways from the conference? Obviously, you're there in a bit of a different role. You're representing an ETF provider, but was there anything that stood out to you?
No, certainly this conference keeps getting bigger and bigger. It's a place where, you know, there was worries as a provider, all, you know, all you're talking to is your peers in the industry. But really, there is all the home office relationships. Everybody that you want to be in front of is down at that conference. So for people who haven't been there, I think it's a great peer networking opportunity. And we could see really the rise of financial, social media, Twitter, the groups that get together. A lot of the conversations beyond even just the conference sessions, getting to interact with your peers and clients there is really sort of next to no other conferences. So it's really a great conference to be at and get to network with.
All right, so I want to ask you about two WisdomTree ETFs that came up during our panel discussion. Both of these seem to generate a lot of interest. The first is the WisdomTree 9060 U.S. Balance Fund, ticker symbol NTSX. So this is basically a levered 60-40 stock bond portfolio. Take us from there. Explain the idea behind this.
I think first, you know, when you think about one of the panel discussions we had was what is the role of alternatives and how do you fit them into a portfolio? You know, when we talk to a lot of investors, I think one of the main questions is, if you have alternatives, which tend to be higher fee, more complex, opaque strategies, the question is, well, how do you fit in? What is it going to replace when you put this into a portfolio? What are you going to sell? Is it going to be your stocks? Is it going to be your bonds? And, you know, a lot of these alternative products have, you know, bond-like volatility, but they're more, you know, in this higher fee, opaque structure. Will you really sell bonds to get something that you're just less comfortable with? And it's one of the big challenges. And so what we look at is 90-60 NTSX. You know, we look at that as a way to anchor a core, and if you put two-thirds of a portfolio in a 90-60 strategy, two-thirds times 90 is 60, and two-thirds times 60 is 40, you get that 60-40 representative type exposure, and then you have a third of your portfolio that you can use for other diversifying strategies. And the question is, well, what would you want to complement this 90-60 with? Certainly you're taking traditional bonds and using bond futures, and so you're losing sort of the cash piece. When you think about what is a bond, it's sort of the short-term interest rate plus the longest duration future type exposure. If you think about a bond, is cash plus the futures. And so you want something that has sort of cash plus kind of returns. So some people think a managed future strategy where your collateral is in cash and you add sort of this trend component on top of it might be, you know, one of those sort of ideal strategies. But you'd also think of it as even if you just substituted more bonds in the portfolio, what you're getting is you're getting that bond future diversification on top of equities that you would have had with the traditional 60-40. So there's been some research on just how this more diversified portfolio solution, if you think about just replacing equities, you're getting this bond futures diversification on top of the equities, and that will allow you to get a more efficient portfolio. But I think the general sense was 90-60 helps you add more room for alternatives when you're building these capital-efficient type portfolios.
Jeremy, anytime some investors hear the word leverage, they automatically think more risk. So what does the risk profile look like here? What are the additional risks of a strategy such as this?
Yeah, I mean, certainly you're taking $100 and you're putting $90 in equities. So in a way, you're delevering your equity exposure because you're instead of for every $100, you get $100 of equities. You're getting $90 of equities, $10 of actual sort of cash, and then $60 of bond futures. So compared to if you were just replacing an equity exposure, you have less equities, but now you're substituting $60 of bond futures exposure for that $10 of equity exposure that you're not taking on. And so the question is really then the correlation structure between bond futures and equities. And so you could say, what is your worst case scenario? Is if you had a sharply spiking interest rate, so the 10-year went from, you know, 260, 270 to 350, so you had a 1% rise in interest rates, you know, how much do those bond futures decline, and does the equities decline by the same amount? You know, which one has more, you know, are you worse off than if you just had the same $100 in equities? You know, there's a lot of times that you look at the last time we had a market that was where the equities sold off driven by rising rates, in early 2018 you had some of that. Now, the bond futures didn't decline by as much as the equities, so I think you still would have got some diversification from this kind of strategy. But so that relationship between bond futures and equities, when you think about what are you comparing it against, is it 100% equities, is it traditional 60-40, that will lead you to say, is that extra exposure through the bond futures something that's going to hurt you or help you?
On that equity exposure, is that all U.S. large cap?
Yeah, this was idea was, you know, there's a lot of the motivation behind this is there's a lot of active managers who will actively manage a portfolio of fixed income bonds and then add sort of complex equity derivatives on top of that. Some of the big fixed income managers do that. And this idea was nobody's done this with a beta-like solution, so we're using basically U.S. large cap equity beta, sorry, cap weighted equity beta with a bond futures that looks just like a laddered, you know, treasury bond futures curve. And so it was idea to bring it in a sort of relatively low fee, 90-60, 20 basis points. So compared to the higher fee active managers who are doing it, that was the concept of doing this sort of additional exposure, capital efficiency at a pretty low fee.
All right. Another ETF that generated quite a bit of discussion on our panel was PUTW, the WisdomTree SIBO S&P 500 Put Right Strategy Fund. And incidentally, you gave a great 3-minute presentation on this during the Hidden Gem session at the conference, which is always one of the most popular sessions. But explain what a put writing strategy is and then what this ETF does.
So PUTW was designed to track that CBOE S&P 500 Put Right Index. And you know, it was the first in the sense of being the beta to put writing. So there's been some covered call type strategies in the marketplace in the past. This was sort of a first for the put writing concept. And the idea is when you think your upside is limited in equity, so when you think you're getting later stage in the cycle, and you can you transform some of your traditional equity market risk to sort of premiums that you get from selling options. Now, your upside is only really your returns come from this option premium that you're selling. So on the downside, you have equity beta. You basically go to one equity beta on the downside when the market falls by more than the premium you've collected. So there's a strike price on every option. We're writing at the money 1 month options in that PUTW fund. So when the price falls by more than strike price, you basically start getting equity beta of one on the downside, and your upside is basically capped at the premiums that you're collecting from selling the options. And so I think this is when you're in the latter stages of a market, but you still want some equity beta. The equity beta tends to be 0.5 to 0.7, depending on the market. You get, you're writing these 50, they're sort of at the money puts every month. You know, the beta is not one, but it tends to be lower vol than traditional S&P-like structures. We see it for people who want to have some equity beta, but just think that the gains are more limited. So this is just another way to get some equity market exposure.
Jeremy, you mentioned lower vol, and it was interesting. During our panel discussion, one of the other panelists, Nancy Davis with Quadratic Capital, you and her sort of went back and forth on how to think about a put writing strategy. And she felt very strongly this was not a way to minimize volatility. She actually said it was a short vol strategy. How should investors think about this?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely different concerns on different levels. Like when you, we look at it as it's certainly not just a short vol strategy. It has to do with options, right? So the fund is selling at the money options. And the level of option premium you're going to collect is dictated by the level of volatility. And so you do, and we are saying there is amount of equity beta to the strategy. I mean, you do have equity beta on the downside. As the markets fall below the strike price, your beta goes to one. There's a question on how much leverage you have. There's no real leverage in this strategy. It's cash secured puts. The amount of notional options you're writing are secured fully by the cash that you hold. You're holding treasury bills in the portfolio from all the from premium that you're writing, and you're not going more levered on the downside. So there were these VIX type strategies in the market that were short vol and have different reset periods, that there's different fears on that. This is an equity, it's a combination of returns coming from some of the equity beta as well as some of the vol. You are selling options, so you are collecting premium. So there's an element of volatility that increases the amount of premium income you can collect, but it's not as explicit. I think we were sort of talking past each other in some of those things, but there is an element of vol that relates to your returns in these strategies.
Jeremy, this is Jason Lank. When I think about alternative ETFs like PUTW, the million-dollar question is, how do I use it? Where does it fit into the portfolio? Again, something you alluded to earlier. Do you hold this out? Should I consider this a core holding, a bellwether, or is this more of a tactical tool? For example, if I'm anticipating choppy markets, then I think this tool might adapt well to that, and so that's how I would use it. But how would you respond to that?
You know, I think we, in some of our model portfolios, we've included it in the alternatives bucket. We think of it as, I mean, I know there has been some of the big private banks and some of the big institutional consultant firms that have looked at it as a, S&P 500 type replacement or using it as a U.S. equity exposure. And so, because there is an equity beta to it. I mean, certainly, it keeps drawing on the downside. You do have the equity beta risk to the downside, and you're just transforming, unlimited upside in traditional equities to capping your upside through selling the premium and only collecting the options, income that you're selling in PUTW. So I do think of it as filling out that alternatives bucket, and it is for people who think you're later stages and you're not expecting very wild upside in the markets. If you think you're like a 0 to 7% type return environment, you just want to get have some equity beta, but not the full equity beta that you would in owning the S&P 500, there's one way to do that. And that's the types of clients that we see interested in.
Jeremy, we only have about 2 minutes left here. I did want to ask you about another ETF, the WisdomTree Floating Rate Treasury Fund, ticker symbol USFR. This has been a tremendous success story. This thing has grown into a $2 billion fund just over the past year or so. Why do you think this ETF has resonated with investors?
Yeah, so this was one that started last year at $1 million and ended January.
It's amazing.
So it is one of those nice success stories. And this was, you know, in some ways, a lot of what WisdomTree is designed to do. We've talked about a lot of our innovation and being trying to add value on top of the market. This was one that it was a beta solution. It was the first security issued by the U.S. government since TIPS were introduced in 1997. It is a floating rate security, so it was least credit risk. It was government paper instead of sort of LIBOR floaters or corporate floaters or bank loans that a lot of people use for floating rate exposure. And as the Fed was hiking rates, it was the shortest duration bond ETF in the market. So as people look for duration management tools and they don't want to take the credit risk in additional LIBOR floaters or bank loans, we look at this as the shortest duration. Rates reset every week. It's tied to the weekly three-month T-bill auctions. And, you know, at 15 basis points, it's a good short duration treasury fund, and it sort of resonated a lot in the market as the Fed was hiking rates. But it, because it's treasuries, it's good core U.S. bond exposure for people looking to manage their different duration buckets.
Well, Jeremy, with that, we'll have to leave it there. As always, really appreciate your time. Again, glad we were finally able to meet in person last week. Thanks for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
That was Jeremy Schwartz, Global Head of Research at WisdomTree. And you can learn more about their ETF lineup by visiting wisdomtree.com. That'll do it for ETF Prime. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. You can visit leggmason.com to learn more about their broad range of investment strategies. Podcasts of ETF Prime are available at etfprime.com, etf.com, iTunes, and Spotify. You can follow me on Twitter, at Nate Geraci. Next week, we'll be joined by Ethan Powell, founder and CEO of Impact Shares. We'll talk impact investing and look at their lineup of socially conscious ETFs. And then Western Asset Management's Ellen Kammer will spotlight two actively managed bond ETFs from Legg Mason. Until then, have a great week, everyone.